Hi, and welcome to my podcast series, The New Abnormal, which aims to make sense of our COVID-19 world today and tomorrow. I'm Sean P. Lodishenesi, researcher, author, and speaker from Brand Positive. As a researcher, I've spent 20 years conducting ethnographic interviews on global projects. Along the way, I've been lucky enough to have met some amazing people, from psychologists to activists to creatives, some of whom I'll be talking to in this series. I'm also the author of The Post-Truth Business, which focused on trust, empathy, and privacy, while my second book, Influencers and Revolutionaries, looked into innovation, behavioural change, and the climate crisis. So, I hope you enjoy the interviews, and if so, please tell your friends, leave a rating, and watch out for our other episodes. Now, without further delay, let's crack on with today's podcast. So today I'm really pleased to be joined by Sarah Wheeler, prize-winning non-fiction writer noted for her accounts of polar regions. Her books include the international bestseller Terra Incognita, which tells a story of a seven-month journey in Antarctica. The Daily Telegraph reviewer wrote of it, "I do not think there will ever be a better book written about the Antarctic." In it, she mentions sleeping in the captain's bunk in Scott's hut. While in Antarctica, she read The Worst Journey in the World, an account of the Terra Nova expedition, and she later wrote a biography of its author, Apsley Cherry-Garrard, which I have to say, by the way, is one of my favourite books of all time. Her other books include The Magnetic North, Notes from the Arctic Circle, which was the winner of the Banff Adventure Travel Prize. And for it, she was frequently abroad for years, travelling to Russia, Alaska, Greenland, Canada, and North Norway. Her book, Oh My America, Second Acts in a New World, records the lives of women who travelled America in the first half of the 19th century. Fanny Trollope, Fanny Kemble, Harriet Martineau, Rebecca Berland, Isabella Bird, and Catherine Hubach, and the author's travels in pursuit of them. Sarah's latest book, Mud and Stars, Travel in Russia with Pushkin and Other Geniuses of the Golden Age, came out just prior to the pandemic. Wow. So, Sarah, what an extraordinary list. Hi, and how are you?
I'm very good, thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
My mind boggles in terms of knowing where to start with such an extraordinary list, but I'll just give you one more quote before we get going. It's me quoting you. Minute curiosity is the requirement of the writer, as it is of the biographer, novelist, and poet. Out there on the road, I've often found that the most aimless and boring interludes yield, in the long run, the most fertile material. So, just to start with one of your, no doubt, many, many anecdotes, just tell us all about travelling the Trans-Siberian Railway in winter.
I recommend wholeheartedly anybody who does the Trans-Sib to do it in winter. First of all, there's no other foreigners on board, so you have more of a sense of the adventure of travelling. And also, it gives one such a sense of the scale of Russia. One goes for seemingly days on end with nothing but the endless taiga. Chekhov said only the birds know where the taiga ends, and the frozen steppe and the birch trees. I mean, days, it seems, on end. And then suddenly, usually in the middle of the night, one draws into the most enormous neoclassical Soviet station, that kind of architecture that says, don't come in here, it's not for people like you. Illuminated, brightly lit. And there'll be one babushka on the platform selling those dried fish, you know, that look like table tennis bats, through the window. And you have half an hour, everybody quickly puts on all their kit, boots and hats to stretch their legs, walk along the platform to and fro, and then it's back on again, and then it's 48 hours more of the endless taiga.
It just sounds magical. And I love also in the book, we talk about, you know, the train follows the day from village to village, first lights, shoveling snow, children walking home from some lonely school, lights going on in disintegrating Siberian huts. Just such an epic visual feeling that you put across there. And just so, I mean, so going through the train then, so, I mean, during the day, the minutiae of it, just, yeah, so what was it like being on board?
Well, there's two things when you're on board. It's the outside world, which you just look at in a very agreeable, warm fog and see the detail, as you just said there, and children going to school and all the rest of it, or life going on, or then for hours on end, no life going on beyond the birds because it's uninhabited territory. And then there's what goes on inside the train, with that sort of wonderful microcosm that train travel gives. For example, there was... Each compartment has there's a corridor outside, and that has the power plugs in it. So pretty straightforward to recharge one's phone. But there was only one double one on every corridor, and I noticed that there was a lead from both of the points going into the next compartment to mine. So I waited and thought until they'd finished. But anyway, after 36 hours, I knocked on the door of their compartment, and real Russian entrepreneurship. They had a bar of points connected, which were sequestered by them, real entrepreneurship in action. And one had to pay a certain number of rubles in order to rent one of the sockets until one's phone was charged. And there was no unpleasantness or discussion or anything. It was just a transaction. And there was something quite pleasing about it.
Fantastic.
And another thing was, if someone, there was a stewardess at the who's in charge of every carriage, and she rules it like a dictator, the carriage. And one of her tasks is to clean the bathroom at the end of every carriage. And there's a timetable pinned on the door of the bathroom saying what time of day that's going to be out of action. Well, first of all, you have to navigate the fact that all Russian trains going on the transcontinental routes, like the Transsib does, use Moscow time. So it's not the time that your watch says, and the transit crosses a lot of time zones. So you've got to navigate that. Anyway, one time I was observing her as she put the no entry sign on and set about cleaning the bathroom. And in this corridor I've talked about, there was net curtains. And she unhooked the net curtain, slipped off the net, and used the pole, the curtain pole, to clean the lav. Again, one has to admire, I think, the resourcefulness. It's a characteristic of Russia, and a characteristic perhaps of all extreme environments.
Yeah. Fantastic. And in terms of extreme environments, so going back, if you like, to the start of your story. So having you read classics and modern languages at Oxford. So if I, what happened next between Oxford and then finding yourself in the Antarctic? How did that come about?
OK, well, I always knew I wanted to be a writer. And I always knew I wanted to be a non-fiction writer. Maybe we'll talk a bit about that later. So after college, for about 5 years, I had a series of jobs from waitressing and then upwards to working for a publisher, working for a magazine, a very standard trajectory to pay the bills while building up a freelance portfolio, which took a long time. It took about 5 years, didn't it? And then I got my first book contract. So fairly standard. And then I did all kinds of other work, other writing work along the way, building up to supplement income. All very standard. Now, I always knew I was a nonfiction writer, as I've said. And I kind of knew that travel was going to be a big part of it. I think there was something intuitive that all I really want to write about, Sean, is what it is to be human. What else is there? But you need to smuggle all that in. And it seemed to me that travel was the perfect vehicle in which to smuggle in questions of reaching for the transcendental and how to forge hope from a desperate world. And it seemed to me that things like the stewardess cleaning the lavatory and train timetables and getting scabies and all the rest of it was a perfect framework, a decoy to smuggle in the more difficult stuff. So I just gravitated towards that. I never, didn't really, can't remember ever thinking about any of those things in the kind of way I've just told you. And my first book was about a Greek island, which is called Evia. I had an idea, which was a good one, if it wasn't well executed in the end by me. It's a good idea because nobody knows about that island, despite being the second biggest. Basically, it's because it's so mountainous, it's never been able to have an airport, so it sort of saved it from the depredations. But I had an awful lot to say about Greece, having studied classics and modern Greek, lived a lot in Greece and been very interested in orthodoxy. And so I had a lot to say before I started the book, and it turned out to be a labour of love, that book. And there was too much labour and too much love, not enough art. And it's not very good as a result of that. In fact, a few years ago, my publisher decided to put out a second edition in the usual way, you know, with a new cover and a new introduction by me. And I started off this introduction by saying what I just said to you. So my publisher rang me up and said, well, honestly, Sarah, I don't see how we can publish a book where the author says in the first line it's not very good. So my agent said to me, you've got to go somewhere you don't know anything about now. It's just really good advice. And I'd always been fascinated by Chile, only because I couldn't imagine how a country could function that was 37 times longer than it is wide. So off I went to Chile, did a six-month journey from the Peruvian border to Cape Horn. I thought it would be good to enter Cape Horn. I learned Spanish on the way down and had a really happy time. First thing I did was interview the weatherman at the national television station, because I thought how extraordinary to have a job where at 6 o'clock every single night of the year you had to say, tomorrow it's going to be hot at the top, warm in the middle and cold at the bottom, because such is a country that has that extraordinary geography. I thought, as I said, that the journey was going to end at Cape Horn, but to my annoyance, as I went down, I realised that every map of Chile has this triangle of land hanging off the bottom of it, and that is Chilean Antarctica. Chile is one of the seven claimants of Antarctic territory. Now, that claim is not recognised, means nothing globally, but it means a huge amount to a young country. And coming from England, as I do, being very English, as I regrettably am, I think it takes a lot of thinking to understand what the national psyche of a young country involves. And one of the things it involves is being very worked up about borders and territory. And anyway, so I had to go down to Chilean Antarctica to complete my portrait of contemporary Chile. I didn't know anything about it. I wasn't interested in it. And to cut a long story short, I hitched a lift on a Chilean Air Force plane and saw this ice desert 1.5 times the size of the continental United States. It was unowned, unspoiled, unpolluted, perfect territory for a travel book. Now, the whole notion of the owning voices and appropriation was still, people think that's a new, young writers, they think that's a new thing, but it isn't. It was going strong then about, well, what about all these Chileans, you know, who own the country, own the metaphorical country, blah, blah. So one was very aware of it then. And that's why Antarctica appealed to me massively, because there's no indigenous population. So no problem of that kind. Yay. Well, had I known at the time how difficult it was going to be to arrange the trip, I wouldn't have had the spirit for the fight. But it's like waiting for a bus. You invest so much time in it, and then you've got to keep going. Anyway, it took me 2 years to organise, and I became the American government's writer in residence in the Antarctic, and spent 7 months trundling around, living mostly in my tent, staying in science camps. Now, I want to make it clear I don't have any sledge pulling skills, nor do I write books with me of the frozen beard on the front, and do journeys to show how dead I can get compared to the next bloke. That is not what I do. I don't have those skills, so I couldn't, even if I wanted to, which I don't. Everybody always asks me what's my favourite story about the Antarctic, and there are so many. And in fact, in lockdown, I've been looking through my photographs, my transparencies they were then, and I've just absolutely loved it. And of course, there's so many things once forgotten. I've really enjoyed that. But I did find a photograph of a camp I stayed in with five wonderful benthic geologists from the University of Idaho, and they were studying the seabed under about 3 meters of ice. It was off the Ross Ice Shelf. So they drilled holes in the ice, put down ROVs, remote operated vehicles, which sent back images. You could see what was there. Well, that might sound like esoteric science suitable for the Ig Nobel Prize. But actually, when you see the sediment at the bottom of the Southern Ocean, it gives important clues about how fast the glaciers are melting. So this is a key thing to the big grail of our time, climate change, how fast it's melting, how fast is that sediment moving, and all the rest of it. They were a great team. They were well established by the time I helicoptered in. I used to go travel around on resupplies, so no one ever went anywhere for me. I hopped on and off, and because they were an established team, the bathroom arrangements, it's worth spending some time getting them organized. So they had the most wonderful, they drilled a hole in the ice, which they kept open. Now, that in itself is a huge deal. We won't go into that now. It's really hard to do. facing the most wonderful view of the Mackay Glacier, windbreak all around the back of it, so perfect privacy, the most wonderful bathroom view in the world.
Yeah, yeah.
Except on my second day, I was making tea, ferrying it around camp. You know, my main job always was to make myself useful and make people like me, because I was just an interloper. But luckily, there's always a lot of donkey work to do in science camps. So the thing was to get on and do it. So I would sit on frozen, the lips of frozen lakes in the dry valleys, for example, spooling out rubber coil for hours on end. Anyway, so I was bringing this tea across, and one of the scientists, the geologists, had been using the facilities I've just described, and he said he came skidding through camp with his wind pants around his ankle. I said, God, Mike, what's the matter? And he'd been enjoying this view I've just told you about, and a seal had come up through the hole, and of course it's this hot, fishy breath. I'll leave that image with you, Sean.
Fantastic. There we are. That's the cover of an epic.
I think lockdown's bad. That's what's coming next, okay?
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely superb. And then turning things literally on their sort of a polar axis, and then up to the Arctic. And one of the amazing points that I read about, one of the points you make about, you know, the magnetic north. I love as you say, if the Antarctic is a symbol of what the planet could be, the Arctic represents what the planet actually is. This is a book about beauty and horror. So go on then. Why is it a book about beauty and horror?
Well, I should say, before I give you the explanation, the answer to that question, there's many years between those two books, and there's a reason for that.
Yeah.
There's a reason for that, which is part of the answer. So the Antarctic is unowned, as I've said. It's pristine. It's not anything horrible. We haven't mucked it up. It's a symbol of hope and a symbol of what the Earth could be, and it's idealism and all the rest of it. And that's what young writers should be interested in, idealism. All writers are interested, should be interested in hope. I'll speak more about that later. But idealism and a symbol of idealism, that's a very purity and unsullied nature. That's, I mean, it's an obvious attraction for a young woman writer, and that's Terra Incognita is a young woman's book. And I wasn't interested in the Arctic because it's everything that the Antarctic isn't. I mean, for example, the Antarctic's a continent, it's defined. No one's going to argue about what the Antarctic is. What's the Arctic? We're arguing about it night and day because all certain subsidies depend on it. It's certainly not the Arctic Circle. Well, where is it? Argument. It's owned. It supports life. There's tons of people there, and they're all indigenous peoples who've been dragged into the cash economy by various governments, and it's all horrible and all gone to pot, and it's really polluted, and it's a big hydrocarbon centre of the universe, and it's just, you know, God problems. Well, so I wasn't interested in it. So after Terra Incognita, I did some other stuff. I'm very much a generalist as a writer, a generalist. I felt it in my heart from the word go, and I still feel, well, someone's got to be one. I'm 60 next month, so the process of aging is very much on my mind, and sort of landmark birthdays, you turn, and I do look back on that now and think, well, I wonder about that now. Anyway, I was and I'm a generalist. So I went and did other things writing-wise. And then as 50 approached, the last landmark birthday, I started looking north, and I realised if the Antarctic is a symbol, as you've said, of potential, what the Earth could be, the Arctic's a bloody symbol of what the Earth is, from the reasons I've said. And those are the things that appeal to the middle-aged, that sort of elegiac melancholy of middle age, because that's much more representative of life, isn't it? That is what life's like. Life's not like the Antarctic, it's like the Arctic. So it appealed to me from all kinds of points of view. And to a certain extent, that was the beginning of the project. And the end is the same. And I specifically do end the book on one thing, which I think exemplifies that. And it was finding beauty among the horror. And that is the writer's duty and all our duties, really. And I think you always can. I really believe that. And, I really admire your podcast series for trying to stress that hope and resilience and community. I'll talk a bit more about community later. those are things it's our job to find. One doesn't have the luxury of, poncing around on Antarctic ice thinking about symbolism and how penguins don't have predators on ice. Everything has a predator in the Arctic, pretty much, and including people. So I spent as much time as I could with Indigenous peoples and tried to disentangle the very real horror that's been inflicted on them by being dragged into a cash economy, which I soon learned all the circumpolar nations all do it in their own way, but the result's always the same, which is bad for the people concerned. But it was finding the beauty of their lives, the meaning of their lives, which is still there despite the arrival of the usual suspects like McDonald's and all the rest of it. I mean, McDonald's doesn't go that far north, but you know what I mean. And the young people I spent time with and their dependence on the internet, but still there was the value and the sense of the persistence of the old values and of a culture that was strong and that was going to outlive perhaps the golden arches, and or even in some subliminal way and meanings we don't know. And I end the book in the White Sea. So I start the book in the far east of the Russian Arctic. Russia, of course, has more polar coastline than any other country, sort of opposite, just 2 minutes from Alaska, there, Chukotka, which is this enormous region. The Trans-Siberian couldn't even think about going there, which is saying something.
Wow.
Yeah, and it's the size of France, and there's no roads. And there's one capital city, which a few thousand people live in. Anyway, I started off there. The Russians was sort of emblematic of the Russian Arctic, and then I ended up west of the Urals of the White Sea. As you know, Russia's kind of divided into it's geographically divided west of the Urals and east of the Urals, but much more importantly, it is figuratively divided. Anyway, so this was the White Sea, and there's this island called Solovki, the Solovetsky Archipelago, and where I went to write about the Arctic. And it was the site of the first monastery, Solovki, a really sort of holy place with great sort of stories of the monks, rowing their little tiny boats and great sense of stillness descending like a benediction and the Orthodox rites of the centuries and this and that. There's also the site of the first gulag. So another chorus of voices got added to those of the chanting monks. Mm. And so it was a place of the greatest holiness and the greatest horror. And walking through the woods, I knew I was literally treading on bones. And wow. There was some archaeology there, an archaeological site there. Well, an archaeological site. It was some Bronze Age stone cairns. They had been dug, but they just looked like there was a series of them, Bronze Age warrels on the ground around the island. And I knew from the archaeological reports that had been published that nobody knew what they were. They knew roughly Bronze Age. Probably fishermen would have come that way, White Sea fishermen who've been coming and going since the last ice age, presumably. And it was probably, could have been some ritualistic form of worship place for them, or it could have been a Bronze Age rubbish dump. They could have all been Bronze Age rubbish dumps of some kind. And the point I Well, the point I wanted to make at the end of my book was sometimes it's better not to know. Let that beauty and horror. We can't explain everything. We will never explain everything. I think perhaps an issue quite relevant to the current plague, what we're living through now, we're not going to understand anything. We certainly have to accept we don't know when it's going to end, if it's going to end, what the future will look like. It's always going to be in our minds, will it descend again, even when it is over, which we assume now it will. So that learning to live with unknowingness was very much part of my Arctic story and something I wanted to explore. And it did seem to me it was part of that elegiac melancholy of middle age. And one of the things I do now as part of my writer's life is I have a fellowship at Brasenose College, Oxford, which happens to be my alma mater. It's a Royal Literary Fund fellowship. And so I teach undergraduates and graduates, actually, but let's think about talk about the undergraduates now, these really bright young men and women who come to see me, and I teach one-to-one. And so here's the thing, what about them? It's all very well me spouting off, approaching 60, all this hope and uncertainty and this and that, and all of that stuff I'm thinking about is sitting on many decades of wondering about making a fool of myself and living. And they haven't got any of that. And what are they supposed to make of it? And on the whole, I'm struck by what an amazing job they do. That said, one is very aware of the massive data coming at us about mental illness, including among young people, either sparked or exacerbated by this very peculiar situation we're in. So that gives me pause for thought too. And I can't begin to understand their point of view, even though, in fact, I have children that age myself. But it seems to me it's something that's worth thinking about. And I certainly hope that my work, you know, I'd hate to think that my work was only for old bats like me.
Well, can I say, I mean, on that point about, if you like, sort of some epic resilience and points of view and looking to the world around you in the future. So for your book, Oh My America, I love the introduction there. You know, 35 years ago, I went to America after quitting my job as a Parisian schoolgirl, changing francs into dollars and touring the US on a Greyhound bus. What a fantastic start to a book. And so that is, again, just give one quote. I love it. The one about Fanny Trollope, who said, who confessed that she would have liked Cincinnati much better if the people had not dealt so very largely in hogs. Have you been to Bridgewater? Perhaps just talk us about that, because the book is just epic, and the characters in it, the people in it, so Trollope and Kemble, Martineau, Berland, Isabella Bird, and Catherine Hubeck. Just perhaps, yeah, give us a viewpoint on that.
I had such fun writing that book. It was about middle-aged women writers reinventing themselves. Get it? Middle-aged women writers. in fact, five of them were English. One was American. And I'd always loved America, been very attracted to it, enjoyed it, and got on well with Americans. So I spent a lot of time in tents with them in the Antarctic, besides the usual forms of interaction. And I was interested in writing about America, and it seemed to me that an interesting time was that the two middle quartiles of the 19th century, i.e. when America became itself. From the 1820s to the time when the railroad joined the country together. And so my six girls were there then. And the one you mentioned, Fanny Trollope, she was the first one. She went in 1827. I mean, that's early for a British person to go to America. And she went purely for economic through economic need. She had a useless husband. A lot of them had useless husbands, actually. And she had to make some money. And there was a lot of penury and hardship and misery along the way. She left half her children behind, including the future novelist Anthony Trollope, and went up the Mississippi, and various projects failed. In fact, all her projects failed in America. And she came back even more impecunious, various children in tow, than she'd gone. And then she wrote this book, Domestic Manners of the Americans, and that's how she... So America did make her fortune, just made it for her when she got back. And her her waspish comments about Cincinnati, Ohio, were really interesting to me. And so, you know, and I went back and spent a lot of time around Cincinnati area. And then there was Fanny Kemble, who was a few years later. And she was a very famous actress, the Kemble dynasty. I mean, really famous. She was really famous. She was the Kate Winslet of the day. She went on tour in America and in Philadelphia. It was that sort of life there. I'm talking about early 1830s, where her dressing room at the theatre would just be like enormous florist shop from all the beaux dropping by. And anyway, one of them eventually did win her heart. And he was the son of a slave holder, huge deal, big deal family in Philadelphia, huge deal. The father had been involved in writing the Constitution anyway. And so she married this guy in one of those marriages, of which one has observed so many. Why did you do it, Fanny? and went down to live on one of the plantations in the Sea Islands off the coast of Georgia, beautiful part of the world. And she wrote a book, Fanny Kemble, about the reality of slavery. And I think it should be much better known, particularly in this era of re-looking at statues and legacies and so on. Mm. You can't have too many stories of the reality of slavery. I mean, you really can't. And Fanny Kemble's account of the Sea Islands, which was published, it just turns your heart to, I don't know what, but it's just horrifying. But I feel I can't be horrified too often on that score. So she was somebody, of course, she was cast into outer darkness for all of that, lost custody of her children. And she absolutely rose up and started going around giving Shakespeare readings to try and earn money and this and that. So that book, Oh My America, this title, as you know, comes from a John Donne poem, which means something else entirely, in fact. But it's such a great title, particularly as there's an exclamation mark on the end after America. And O is spelled without an H, which I really like. So O, My America. And I know that my readers, all being incredibly intelligent and insightful and with a sense of humour, will all get it, the joke of that title. But it was about reinventions in a new world. And I had great fun writing about women. I got this sort of sideline in polar exploration as a result of going to the Antarctic. And I'm still very interested in that because, I mean, it's just gripping, these sort of fantastic frozen beard stories back then, north and south. And obviously that's kind of all blokes, all men. So Oh My America was my chance to spend my time just with women for a while. And Jane Austen's niece, she was another completely unknown figure who went to California to get away from another useless husband just before the rails, the Golden Spike in Utah, joined the country together. And luckily, we have a lot of her letters. And she's not known at all either. It was a kind of freedom. It was a kind of spending time in America, reading more 20th century American fiction set in all those places, which is a kind of, that's something that's never really ended for me, that my love affair with 20th century American fiction. I can't remember the question now. Sean,
well, we're just talking about, really, I mean, just the epic characters in there. I mean, I love the way that you described them, you know, tough-minded outsiders. They discovered second acts for themselves at a time when the world expected them to disappear politely. Rebecca Berland, a homesteader who'd never been more than 12 miles from her Yorkshire village before sailing to the New World. I mean, just epic stories. He's saying, Can Herbeck, who deposited her useless husband in a madhouse and rode the brand new rails to San Francisco. Love it. Just in terms of the time we have left, I have to ask, just before we go into your viewpoints around some of the points you mentioned already, in fact, or alluded to in terms of your views on hope, community and resilience. But as mentioned, one of my favourite books of all time was the one you wrote about absolutely Cherry Garrard. And just for the uninitiated, one of the youngest members of Captain Scott's final expedition to the Antarctic. As he put, Cherry undertook an epic journey in the Antarctic winter to collect the eggs of the emperor penguin. The temperature fell to 70 below. It was dark all the time. His teeth shattered in the cold and the tent blew away. But we kept our tempers, Cherry wrote, even with God. Wow. You'll say that you miss him every day. He's in your head.
Yeah, writing a biography is a wonderful experience because you live with somebody every day. Literally, every day you walk alongside them. My books tend to take about 3 years each. And so for 3 years, every day you're with somebody and they become much more real to you than the people you live with, and much easier to get along with, I might say. I mean, dead people, they're just great, great company. You talk about that journey, which was, you know, well, Captain Scott said it was the hardest journey ever made, and it was really. And the eggs didn't teach anybody anything about science, and all the theories for which they'd gone to get these emperor penguin eggs were proved to be false before they'd even got them, actually. They didn't know that. So you could say it was a failure. And then there was Captain Scott's last journey to the South Pole. They all were forestalled by the Norwegians, and the five of them died on the way back. So you could say that was a failure. Terry's best friends, and he found the three of them in the tent dead in the spring. So failure all around. And yet he found redemption in his book. If you march your winter journeys is the last line, you will get your reward so long as all you want is a penguin's egg, which is a great lesson for all of us, that there is redemption. Wow. Now, in his life, he only found partial redemption, but that's enough, in my opinion, and experience, that partial redemption is enough. What I mean by that is he had issues with what would now be diagnosed as clinical depression, possibly even bipolar, because he did have manic phases. And there were many years of darkness for Cherry, but there were many years of light as well. And I think he shows us through his book, Through the Worst Journey in the World, which was published in 1922, mm-hmm. interestingly, which mm-hmm. signals such an important year for modernism. Interesting, because that has a lot of bearing on the story I'm telling about Cherry, I think. He did have access to that world of hope, where he knew that those failures were only failures in a very specific sense.
So that point about, taking that point forward about hope, both with regards, perhaps, as you just talking about with Cherry, and also where you are now, so personally, so your take on hope, community and resilience as we are in 2021 in a world where COVID is swirling around and there's so much staggering uncertainty, I mean, always uncertainty. You mentioned, you know, what must, for instance, the young undergraduates be thinking and feeling, the ones that you're dealing with at Oxford. So what are your personal takes on hope, community?
Well, as I've said, I think it's the writer's duty to have hope. And I say that, fully prepared to be accused of being glib, but I think there's always a way of finding some shred of redemption. As I've said, Cherry did, even when the days were so bleak for him, metaphorically speaking, finding hope in the glimpses of light. And I do very much believe in that part of being human is reaching for the transcendental. And what I mean by that is acknowledging is enough, the spiritual dimension of humanity. Surely one of the things that sets us apart from the animals. And we get surrounded, we're bombarded day and night by the things to do with the physical plane, the worldly plane, material goods, advertising and all the rest of it, things to do with our own physical appearance, and also intellectual plane, our reading lives and ideas and politics and all the rest of it. And it astonishes me in the Western world how the spiritual dimension of what you could not deny is there, since Neolithic people crawled into caves and painted pictures on the walls at Lascaux to assist the passage of their kin to the next world. That's what cave paintings are, right? You can't deny. I'm not talking about religion. I'm talking about the human desire to reach out to the transcendental. And a reach is enough. And that's what I put forward as hope. It's reaching. Some people do it through meditation. I've never been very good at that. Sitting still, thinking about it, just not thinking about those other bloody things is enough. And just acknowledging that, I think, is hope in itself. And going beyond this earthly realm in some sense in our own heads, getting things in perspective, I find that helps me massively with this current imprisonment. People say to me, as I travel so much with my work, gosh, you must feel like a caged animal. Several people have said that to me during the pandemic. And I don't particularly, because I think I sort of escape into the life of the mind, and through that, through thinking, and the life of the mind can help me to see other people's maps to the transcendental. I mean, a lot of the writers I most admire, like Cherry, who are not by any shape or, in any shape or form religious writers, do acknowledge, yeah, there's something out there, something we can connect to, and the connection can be fleeting. For me, it's always really fleeting. And I think for most people, it's fleeting. Anybody who claims to be permanently plugged into the national grid of spirituality, well, good for them. But it's a fleeting glimpse, is as much as we can hope for, I think. But it's enough. That is enough. So I would say that's my main message about hope for myself, is that there is a way of rising beyond, if any, for a second.
And community, I mean, I imagine you, as you're looking out of the Trans-Siberian Express, seeing those children walking back through the snow in scattered empty schoolhouses through, obviously, back to the urban metropolis, etc. So your viewpoints on community and the small stories, the human story along the way.
I have quite a lot to say about community at the present in the pandemic because of a certain interest of mine. I come from a working class family in the West Country, and I grew up with one sibling who's 18 months younger than me. And he is permanently brain damaged. He's learning disabled. I don't know what it is. He hasn't got this or that. He certainly hasn't got a syndrome. He's got nothing wrong with him physically. Not genetic. So maybe it's something that happened to him as a baby. We don't know what it was, but he's massively cognitively impaired and can't read or write and has huge behavioural problems, very violent, all the rest of it. So, let me just leap forward. The reason it's on my mind more than usual right now is because you probably might have heard in the press there's a lot of issues about where do the learning disabled stand in the queue for vaccines.
Yeah.
I've been very slightly involved with that. And it seems to me a great sign of how marginalised these learning disabled people are, that they haven't been considered. And a lot of our siblings are getting vaccinated before our disabled siblings, even though that's wrong. They're the ones that need our help. It is our duty. If you have any sense of community in any cell of your body, it is our duty to look after the learning disabled. Of course, the physically disabled as well. The only reason I'm making a distinction is because that's what I know about. I would like to mention there as well that I guess it's kind of semi-natural that I should be drawn to stories of other siblings of disabled people. And I am actually a trustee of a charity called SIBS, which supports the siblings of disabled physically. The third sector has decreed that disabled means physically as well as intellectually and as well as life-limiting conditions and all sorts. It's a very broad thing. Anyway, being a sibling, always feeling you've got to run fast enough for two, always feeling guilty, it's all right for you. All the rest of it is a great influence on one's childhood and on one's adulthood too. And I'm a trustee of this small charity, SIBS, which I really believe in. And, you know, I would like other children and adults to have the support I didn't have, just not being alone. I mean, that's the thing. I was the only one, I thought. And just say, you are not alone. It's normal that you feel annoyed and angry, for example. That's an obvious example, but you do feel angry, and it's normal you should feel angry, and it's normal you should feel guilty about things. On and on it goes. And you know, not the parents' attention and all the rest of it. So that's part of what living in a community means, that's very specific to me, And I'm involved in it professionally, as I say. I'm sitting on this board, but also very much in terms of my own experience of family is quite conditioned by that.
Wow. And I know recently, obviously, there's been actually on that exact point a lot of stuff in the media about Joe Wiley's sister, who I believe is currently in hospital with COVID, unfortunately.
We wish her well. I'm very pleased to say that Joe Wiley is a patron of the patron of SIBS.
Oh, okay, excellent.
Yeah.
Moving on to, again with regards to, unfortunately, time being against us now, but in terms of personal resilience, so I mean, to the most, I mean, literally extraordinary extreme, we've spoken about the epics, actually Jerry Garrard, and so you know, teeth shattering in the cold, etc. But I mean, just from your point of view, I mean, epic travels, it has to be said. Where did you get your resilience from in terms of actually just dealing with be it people on trains using the sort of the train curtain pole to clean toilets to sort of travel around up and down very thin countries like Chile through the Arctic and Antarctic, etc. So a lot of time traveling by yourself, albeit alongside others, strangers. So go on then, your resilience.
Well, you see, things like that don't frighten me, not in any meaningful sense anyway. I find it quite easy to be out there. Well, not easy, but straightforward, natural to be out there. It's only really things inside my head that frighten me. Of course I get frightened if I might be about to fall into a crevasse or some nasty man won't leave me alone. But not as much as the demons inside my head, and I know I'm not alone in experiencing that, the black dog and all the rest of it. I feel frightened. I tell you what, the only thing that really frightens me, Sean, is the curtain department at John Lewis. I'm just, you know, domesticity, the walls closing in. If there is a hell for me, that's it, the curtain department at John Lewis.
Well, there we are. And that perhaps is perhaps where we should leave it. But the curtain department at John Lewis, it's out there somewhere, sort of that epic, terrifying sort of room 101. There we are. So what can one say? But to Sarah Wheeler, I mean, prize-winning nonfiction writer doesn't really sum it up. But to say an epic, epic writer, I mean, a poetic writer of absolute beauty who has just written some staggeringly inspiring words. Thank you so much for talking to me today. I found it really, really interesting. So, yeah. Thank you.
You are very welcome. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to the New Abnormal podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. Please leave a rating, tell your friends, and until next time, goodbye.